From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, he was a blustering business fraud who profited from elected office, pretended to care about farmers, and attacked liberal elites when Texas impeached Paul Ferguson. And the best little whorehouse in Texas, the real story of the chicken ranch. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Do you remember in grade school learning about Texas history, and there's one sentence in a textbook that explains that Texas impeached one governor, James Ferguson, and later his wife Ma was elected governor, and that's about all you got. Well, now it's time to fill in those gaps, because it was in the summer of 1917 that Farmer Jim Ferguson was impeached and thrown out of office. The story of the Fergusons' rise and fall and then rise again is told in the book Impeached, The Removal of Texas Governor James E. Ferguson. Jessica Brannon-Ranowski is co-editor.
James Ferguson is a very interesting character. He was a small-town banker who had married into wealth, actually, decided that he wanted to go into politics. Other than just a few being involved in a few local political circumstances, basically just runs for governor. He does that with very little support or infrastructure, does it with a lot of conversation about how rural voters needed to have more of a say. When he does this, he's not really prepared to be governor. Well, first of all, when he passes the primary, in the Democratic primary, that pretty much was being elected governor. Texas was a one-party state. So at that point, he's coming out of left field. They don't expect him to win. They don't even really know very much about him.
Was he using the brand of Farmer Jim Ferguson at the time?
So that kind of starts at that point, but Farmer Jim really becomes more of a brand once he becomes more well known. So he's starting to push that view of himself. The irony of that is there's these wonderful pictures of him standing in a full suit, vest, dress shoes, and the whole nine yards, standing with cows, because he's pushing this image that really doesn't fit.
And he would use farmer colloquialisms in his, you know, country sayings in his speeches to sort of underline that.
And then when Miriam Ferguson runs for governor in the 20s, they push this very, very hard. And again in the 30s. And so this woman, who is actually very stylish, very contemporary, is showing up wearing bonnets to things to push that brand even further, and it's bizarre.
When Farmer Jim Ferguson gets elected governor of Texas, what was his agenda?
What was his public agenda? He's telling people he's representing rural farmers, the rural population in Texas.
Because that's still the progressive era.
It is. At this point, Texas is still significantly more than 50% of the population's living in rural areas. That does not change until after World War II. He has a good constituency if he can gain rural voter support. Looking at the statistics, when you look at voting patterns at that time, the voting patterns weren't much different when he ran for governor than anybody else did. He has a message that's pulling just enough votes over to get just enough support. And the other thing is there's multiple politicians in the Democratic Party that are splitting the vote. He's able to get a majority. And once you're in the governor's office, it's very, very hard for someone to not get reelected the next time. So once he's in, he's in.
And these were two-year terms
at
the time.
Yes, they were two-year terms at the time.
Once he became governor, his primary concern was consolidation of his power.
Well, that's always his concern. What they were really doing is that he was not a successful banker. They were not financially doing well at all when he runs for governor. Through both of his terms in office, and even more so through both of her terms in office, the number one thing they're doing is looking at ways to profit from being governor. That's a heavy thing to say about someone, but all of the information, all of the archives, and people at the time knew it too, that was what they were doing. They're getting payoffs in multiple ways.
How were they doing that?
Well, there's a couple of ways. During his governorship, he's One of the things that he supports enormously, or you could say works against, is he's very much about not having prohibition passed. So he's very much about keeping the sale of alcohol, the distribution of alcohol. He's very much about keeping that legal. And this is the age when prohibition's getting ready to pass any minute. He's backed enormously by brewers. Because if prohibition passed, the brewers are in bad shape. And so he's profiting financially and politically enormously. They're his major backers. And they're about the only ones that are backing him by the time he's going up for impeachment. And that's part of the way that he is profiting financially. They're paying him and making major loans. And one of the actual reason that he's impeached is because he lies and won't give up information about who's made blind loans to him. And it's the brewers.
When you say loans, we'd have to pay him back or not pay him back loans?
Well, in some cases, they're paying off some of his debt. He had incurred an enormous amount of debt when he had been the head of the bank before he'd been governor, and they're paying off his debts. And then he's using that small bank to launder money, basically, to have money provided to him to cover up who it's coming from. The question is, did he have to pay them back? Technically, on paper, they're loans. But what they really are is their stipends. He's being paid to make certain political decisions. So he supports them. They support him.
Is there anything that someone can point to under the James Ferguson's administration that he did that was positive?
Yes. I mean, that's the funny thing about this, that one of the things that he did push very hard was something called the Tenant Farm Act. One of the things that was going on at the time was that an enormous amount of farmers didn't own their land. And because of this, they're at the mercy of the people who do own the land. There was what we would call today rent gouging. So they're being charged enormous amounts of rent. They're being threatened to be thrown off their land that they're farming. They're being charged an enormous amount of maybe percentage of the crops. And one of the things that Ferguson was very much supporting was trying to pass an act through the Texas legislature that regulated that, that made it better on farmers. And the Tenant Farm Act passes almost immediately after he's not governor anymore. Within a few years, it starts going through the courts on whether or not it's legal, and it's found that it's not. It could be argued that the reason that the Tenant Farm Act becomes so enormously unpopular and the push is to revoke it is that he is enormously unpopular by this point, and they are pushing to remove anything that he's backed.
Also, he ran afoul of the UT system?
Very much so. This is how the impeachment starts. Ferguson disliked urban power very, very much. He disliked any of the social groups, any of the elites that live in urban areas. He did not like them. He did not think that they respected him enough. And a feud starts, especially with the urban elites in Austin, the moment he becomes governor. He's making claims that they have snubbed his wife and his daughters and him, and that they don't take him seriously. Not that that's not completely true. Part of that also is that he's being supported by a certain area of the Democratic Party that they are against. So it's a political thing as well. There's already a problem. It's very early on in his first term as governor. And that problem keeps developing. He makes the argument that, you know, I'm a banker, that I want to see all the budgets from the university. And the way that it works, and the way that it has always worked to some extent, is that to line item budget down to a dollar for what the university is spending is impossible. He wanted to see an extremely detailed budget, but more so as kind of a financial attack on the University of Texas. So he gets embroiled in this problem with university administrators going back and forth. He removes some boards of regents and puts others on so that he can have a vote even on the board of regents that supports him. And at one point, he vetoes the entire budget for the University of Texas. This is also, and the important part about this is also just as World War I is starting. Universities were not only providing higher educational services, but they're also, and multiple universities, not just around the state, but around the nation, are providing soldier readiness training. They're providing services to individuals around the state on how to preserve food. All of these things are extremely important for the United States to be ready for war. And so when he kills the university's budget, he kills all of these things as well. Well, at least potentially. It never actually dies. The thing he forgot to do was actually veto the entire university budget. He goes through and he line by items, vetoes everything, but he didn't line item veto the total. So the legislature decided they weren't going to pay any attention to it. But it was an attack on the University of Texas. And that was probably the worst political move he could have made.
Just a point of clarification. You say that World War I just started, but it was had started in 1914. It was just right when it was in April 1917 when the United States decided to enter World
exactly,
War
I. Exactly. Exactly. So that's what I mean by World War I just started is the U.S. is really getting involved at this point. So war readiness is extremely important.
So when James Ferguson, they have the impeachment, how big of a deal was that in the mind of the public?
Oh, it's extremely dramatic. They're following it every single day. This is very much like modern political drama as well. People are always checking in and seeing what's going on. That's what was going on. And the newspapers and radio were playing up to this enormously, especially newspapers. And you couldn't open a newspaper in Texas without finding out what someone had said recently about it. And so the public is following it very, very closely. Some of it was politics for the sake of entertainment. And Ferguson was very, very good at that. His speeches were very passionate. He was very dramatic, very much so fear-baiting. To watch this was like watching a political circus going back and forth every single day. And at that point, a lot of newspapers are printing twice a day. So you'd wake up in the morning to one headline, and then in the evening, you'd get the evening edition, and you'd have yet another headline. And so this was going on and on. The public was very involved.
Jim Ferguson, Paul Ferguson, is impeached. He's mm-hmm. banned from holding public office into the future, can no longer run for office. And now his wife, Ma Ferguson, steps forth. Talk about her. Was she just a puppet of him, an extension of him, or was she her own woman with her own ideas?
Was she governor in her own right? Historians, contemporaries at the time, were very split on that to a large extent. She's been viewed as his puppet for a very long time. Part of that is because of the era that they were in. She couldn't completely legally exist separately from her husband because she was married. And there were certain legal regulations on women who were married. Women were not able to, for example, to open a banking account or have a credit card in their own name if they were married until the 1960s. You have to kind of think of that in that era. She was able to, because by the time she's elected governor and takes office, women have the right to vote. So there has been some political changes, but there was an argument when she was elected that just because a woman could vote didn't mean a woman could hold that office. And there's a court case that goes through trying to remove her to keep her from being able to hold office. So all of that is being played out during her first term as governor. And the questions were, what were her rights? There was some argument, did he still need to sign contracts for her? Which is just the most bizarre thing for us to think about today. But they're having to figure out what are the legal possibilities for women at that point. Beyond all of that, though, is she his puppet in politics? Is she passing what he wants to have done? To some extent, yes, I'll be honest. They're very much working together as a team. And he is very much the one who wants to see her run for office. But she had to do it. She had to run for office, and she had to be able to do these things. He had a desk right outside her office, and he was always there. And he made the determinations of what went in and what went out. But there were a few times you can very much see her personality and her reaction come about. When she's governor, prohibition exists. And one of the things that they're doing is that they're taking fees to pardon people who have been convicted of charges that go along with selling liquor, transporting liquor, all this kind of thing.
Like bootleggers.
Very much so, bootleggers. So they're getting fees and they're getting kickbacks to be able to pardon people. And not just on that, on other charges as well. During all of this, there starts to be talk that, that a certain section of the legislature wants to bring her up on impeachment charges and that they want her to hold a special session to talk about tick eradication, which is a rural issue, right? Because it dealt with cattle. But she's saying, I'm not going to do it. This is what happened to Jim. They're going to impeach me. I'm going to agree to this session and they're going to impeach me. I'm not going to do it. She's really forceful about this. And there were certain things that she supported enormously. She had a voice, very much so. But her voice and his voice were the same one very often.
Jessica Brannon-Ranowski is a professor of history at Texas A&M University Commerce. She was the co-editor of the book Impeached, The Removal of Texas Governor James E. Ferguson. It's published by Texas A&M University Press.
Thank you, fellow Texans, and welcome to the Watchdog Report with yours truly, Melvin P. Thorpe, keeping an eye on what's going on in this beautiful state of ours. This week's spotlight will shine on a shameful situation that has been allowed to exist for close to 100 years. I'm talking about the chicken ranch, my friends. Texas has a whorehouse in it.
Lord have mercy on our souls.
Texas has a whorehouse in it.
Lord have mercy on our souls.
I'll expose the facts, although it fills me with disgust.
The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas opened on Broadway in 1978, and it was a hit musical comedy. In 1982, it was turned into a film starring Burt Reynolds and Dolly Parton. The play and the film told the story about the Chicken Ranch, a brothel that was a Texas institution. But where does the movie end and reality begin? The book Inside the Chicken Ranch exposes how the Chicken Ranch began and how it stayed open and how it was finally closed. It's written by Jamie Lynn Bloschke.
The Chicken Ranch has a long and often confused history, but the thing to realize about it is that the Chicken Ranch itself was not unique. Through much of the 20th century, you couldn't practically throw a stick in a small Texas town anywhere in the state without hitting a brothel. Distinction is that by 1973, it was, for all practical purposes, the last one standing. Many had been closed during the vice crusades of Attorney General Will Wilson in the late 1950s. He's the one who successfully closed down the free state of Galveston with the open gambling and casinos and the Maceo crime syndicate. And he closed down a lot of the brothels and other accepted vice district and operations throughout Texas. And the Chicken Ranch managed to survive mainly because it had ingratiated itself with law enforcement, not just in Fayette County and LaGrange, but also at the state level. Texas Rangers knew about it. DPS knew about it. All the politicians in Austin knew about it.
The history of Texas and open prostitution, red light districts, San Antonio was well known for having a huge red light district. It was known as a sporting town.
Absolutely. And I think a lot of people in San Antonio would be surprised to realize that several blocks that made up San Antonio's red light district is now home to the UTSA downtown campus. A lot of people are surprised to find out that Waco had the state's first legalized red light district on 2 Street, right across the river on their famous suspension bridge over the Brazos River. That was a large vice district there. Every major city had one. Fort Worth had Hell's Half Acre. You know, there was Frogtown, Swamp Poodle over in Texarkana. I mean, you know, every city had one. Austin had Guytown, which is now the warehouse district. It was a very common thing, and the idea was that you regulate it, you keep crime down, you license brothels, and the city gets a revenue stream from this. Around the time of the Prohibition movement, that conflated together with a number of anti-vice movements, and there were crusades and campaigns to close many of these vice districts, and it was World War I that eventually closed most of them because the War Department, fearing venereal disease, would ransack the military forces and deplete our fighting strength, issued an edict that any community that wanted to keep any type of military base would have to close their legalized vice districts. That is what happened in San Antonio.
But you make it sound so neat and tidy, these, you know, organized houses of ill repute. It is organized crime, and you do have this systematic exploitation of women.
Yeah, absolutely. There was one of the big reasons why the regulation approach failed is because there was endemic corruption. There was a lot of payoffs. Brothels weren't raided, so to speak, but any type of streetwalker in the area was. They were picked up regularly. There were people who were favored with the administrations of communities and law enforcement of the communities, and they were left alone. And if they, you know, were able to grease enough palms, they could get law enforcement to target their rivals.
Where was the Chicken Ranch?
The Chicken Ranch was in outside of LaGrange, Texas, a small, typical Texas town settled mostly by German and Czech immigrants. The woman who operated the Chicken Ranch initially, her name was Faye Stewart. She was from Waco. In the early 1900s, she had moved to Austin, taken the working name of Jesse Williams, and had opened a small brothel there in the Guytown District. When the Guytown District was closed, she went to LaGrange around the end of 1913 or the beginning of 1914. The stories differ. It's kind of vague, but she gained control of the various prostitution operations in LaGrange, which were concentrated downtown at the intersection of Travis and Jackson Street. When the community started getting restless about having prostitution in the middle of town, she became proactive. She had already lost the investment she had in one brothel in Austin. So what she did was purchase 11 acres outside of town and move her operations there. And that is the property that ultimately became known as the Chicken Ranch.
Now, the story that I've heard, during the Depression, things got so bad that people would pay, make transactions using chickens. That's how the name
came. Poultry
standard,
yes. Yeah, that is a very popular story, and it was perpetuated by Miss Jessie, Aunt Jessie herself. The truth of the matter, as I learned from Edna Milton, who purchased the property from Miss Jessie, was that that story was just that. It was a story. It was a good public relations scheme. The true story, as related to me by Edna Milton, was that in the 1930s, there was a new grand jury seated, and at least one of the members was concerned about the Chicken Ranch, which was not called that at the time. And so being concerned that any type of charges or investigation would ensue, some members of the community suggested to Aunt Jessie that she go to a nearby hatchery and get 100 chickens, 100 baby chicks, and just turn them loose on the property and go on the tax rolls as a chicken farm. That way they would have a viable cover and people would start looking the other way. And so she did this, and the grand jury turned over, and people more friendly to her cause were appointed to it, and the problem went away. The chickens wandered around the property for a few years, and at some point someone came up with the story that during the Depression people paid for services with chickens, and Aunt Jessie heard that, and being a businesswoman, knew it was good PR, and so she continued to perpetuate that story herself.
The Chicken Ranch continued to flourish despite the fact, I mean, it was the last big brothel in Texas, that, it was sort of a rite of passage for many fraternities at UT or students at Texas A&M to turn up there.
Yeah, it was. With A&M in particular, at the time, for most of the university's history, it was all male and all military. The sister school was, I believe, Texas Woman's University, which was quite a few miles away, so they didn't have dates very often.
These young men grew up to be some of the leaders of Texas. They were able to see their experience at the Chicken Ranch fondly, and they were less likely to try to shut it down, which is one of the reasons why it remained open for so long.
Yeah, very true. Fraternities at University of Texas did that. Miss Edna told me that students from University of Houston and Rice would attend there as well. And you only have to go back to the Clayton Williams and Richards gubernatorial election in Texas, which, you know, if you're old enough to remember it, that was quite a spectacularly entertaining election. Clayton Williams lost in part because he admitted that when he was a student, he at Texas A&M, he went to the Chicken Ranch on occasion and participated in all the debauchery that goes on there.
Texas has changed. We're a more modern society and not willing to tolerate an open brothel that was so publicly viewable.
Once Marvin Zindler started broadcasting what everyone already knew, that there was a house of prostitution operating outside of LaGrange, at that point it became unacceptable.
Right, Marvin Zindler, the colorful Houston television reporter, he broke the story. You don't look at him very favorably.
Marvin Zindler is like everyone, is a very complex character. He had probably the largest ego Texas has ever seen and would cheerfully admit to that fact. I want to phrase, I don't want to sound insensitive, but this was not a case where he was championing a victim, someone who couldn't, it wasn't consumer fraud or someone who had been taken advantage of. Now, that's not to say that prostitution was good. I don't want people to think that I'm an advocate saying, okay, the Chicken Ranch was great. But the life of a prostitute in Texas was oftentimes very violent. There were really very cruel pimps who would literally abduct women and force them into prostitution. This still happens today.
And today we know it as human trafficking.
Yeah.
The interesting part, why people are fascinated with the story of the Texas Chicken Ranch, is the hypocrisy. Texas and many of the people who are involved prop themselves up as righteous, yet many of them were patrons of the Chicken Ranch.
Bingo. I mean, you've hit the nail on the head, and that's one of the things that I touch on in the book, and that's one of the things that is focused on. Actually, that is the focus of the play, The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas, which was originally on Broadway. It's like Inherit the Wind. Okay, the play and the movie Inherit the Wind are not, they're about the Scopes monkey trial painted in broad strokes, but at the core, it's really an allegory of McCarthyism. Okay, the same way with the Chicken Ranch. Some of the high points in the events that took place with the closing of the Chicken Ranch are there, but the play itself is not about prostitution per se. It's about hypocrisy and how politicians and the law and the media in particular knew about it and were willing to turn a blind eye until push comes to shove, and suddenly they're the champion of morals and this place has got to go, even though they had been regular patrons or had known about it for a long time and chose not to act on it.
Jamie Lynn Bloschke is the author of Inside the Chicken Ranch, The Definite Account of the Best Little Whorehouse. It's published by History Press. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org, or you can write directly on our show page at tpr.org. That's where you can listen to past Texas Matters programs, and you can catch us wherever you download your podcast. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.